great to see all these friendly faces here, all of you who couldn't get into Mark's session next door. Please don't hate us. It's not our fault. We have no control over whether they open the door, but we know there's the wall. We do appreciate you being here. We appreciate you coming all the way to Austin as well. This session, or Austin, did I say Austin? Houston. Tiny little states confuse me. I'm from Connecticut.
We're off to a good start.
We're off to a good start.
Rousing start.
So if hopefully you're in the right place, this is a VDI deployment walkthrough session. What we wanted to do was provide you with a perspective on using the components built into Server 2012 for delivering remote session and remote desktop services to your customers and constituents. So the folks up here on the stage today, it's myself. I'm John Kelbley. I'm a data center specialist out of the Northeast, focused on virtualization. And with me is Rich McBrine.
And I'm a data center specialist, covering education across the East Coast of the United States, both K-12 and higher education. And what we're going to talk about today is not only the technology, but also how we've seen it applied. John tends to work in state and local government accounts,
right,
mostly.
Yep.
We'll try and bring some reality of how people are actually using these technologies.
Right. So what we intend to walk through is a little brief background on VDI. I'm sure we've all heard a great deal about it. Do a little bit of level setting. Then we'll try to walk through some of the administrative components in Server 2012 and how you would actually deploy it and how you would manage it. And then show you how remote app behaves on the client side, some of the configuration pivots to understand. And then also maybe we'll talk about, because we had a request from someone who got here early, we'll talk maybe a little bit about Azure Remote App and show you some of that as well, and show it how it manifests itself on some of these other devices, because Rich has a Mac up here as well as an iPad. We'll just show you what that looks like. Hopefully that'll work out. The takeaways for the session are to understand that Windows Server 2012 R2 includes the ability to do full remote session and VDI deployments should you choose to do it, and it works really well. It's easy to do, and you can actually deliver these services to a variety of clients, including iOS, Android, Mac, Windows, of course, and Windows RT.
Windows, right. And that's based on some new technology we released that covers those platforms. So it used to be you had to get other partners involved if you wanted to have iOS devices use remote app. Now you don't have to do that. And we're going to show you that stuff live as we go through today. And we're going to be pretty demo heavy. That's our intent.
So we're going to try to be.
If we rush through slides, it's not because we don't like our lovely slides.
Right. So with that, we'll get into the VDI background and level setting piece of it. Again, to reiterate, if you're using Server 2012 and Server 2012 R2, you have all the components you need to deliver remote desktop services to your user communities, either through remote app, being just scraping out a single app and delivering that application experience to that device, or a full remote shared desktop, kind of old school Citrix style, like people used to do, or old terminal server style, right? Or you can actually very simply deliver pooled VMs, which are stateless VMs that essentially repersonalize every time a user uses them, and their profile information is actually projected into the VM. Or you can give people a persistent VM that's always theirs that they can have administrative access to. And it can all be deployed using little more than maybe an ISO image for a client operating system and server manager or PowerShell, your choice.
Right, and the thing that I like about this slide and our capabilities that we brought to the table is you can mix and match this stuff. It's not one or the other. And then from an administrative standpoint, because John and I are both data center people, if it were our lives, if we could control everything, everybody would just have a terminal and you'd be connecting back into our world and we control everything, right? But the thing that we like about this is we have one centralized set of tools for management, regardless of which ones of these you choose, and we offer up the ability for you to use the right technology based on the right scenario, the right demand of the app as well as the user.
So that was our brief level setting section of the agenda. So now we'll get into the Server 2012 R2 remote desktop setup and administration. Basically, to do the high-level steps of the setup are either server-focused or client configuration-focused. On the server configuration side, adding the services, use the add roles and features wizard that you know. You got to think a little bit about your network. How you're going to isolate your remote desktop services from your users or provide access from a security perspective. And also think about storage. If you're going to be doing a VDI-based versus a session-based delivery, we can talk a lot about storage. In 75 minutes, we could really talk about storage. But we won't get too deep into it other than to point out some one of the coolest use cases in R2 around it. And then you've also on the client side, I know this is a server-side configuration piece, you got to deal with building those VMs if you're doing VM-based delivery, dealing with things like sysprep, certificate deployments and installation in the installation, licensing, which can be quite a challenge in a remote desktop environment, and then also the creation of collections, which is pretty simple. Mm-hmm. On the client side, at a high level, you're going to have to deal with certificate installation so you can securely communicate back to your infrastructure. We'll talk a little bit about that. Web access, you're going to have to think about. And then also start menu access. We'll show you how to provision that up or how to install those access mechanisms for your users and configure them. So how do you add remote desktop services? It's really easy on the server side. If you haven't done it before, and I apologize to those of you who've already deployed remote desktop or VDI on server 2012, you may not get a lot out of this other than some perspective from the session because you already know how easy this is to do. It's very easy. Use the same add roles and features wizard that you've been doing all along with Windows Server. So just like adding DNS or DHCP as services or adding the Hyper-V role to the server, you're going to go through that same wizard, or from PowerShell, just type add Windows feature, right, and add the components. You don't actually have to select all the details of it and configure it. The wizard will add all the roles you need to reboot it as necessary for like a virtualization host that needs the Hyper-V role. It handles all that for you, then the dependencies. So let me just skip to the next slide. Adding the roles and features is pretty easy. I just did a quick screenshot of it. This is a server manager. The roles aren't there. As you may know, if you've played with Server Manager, on the left side of the screen, it enumerates all of the roles that it finds for the servers that are being managed, right? So they're listed there. Underneath File and Storage Services, if RDS was there, it would actually be listed. So adding it, again, is just going through roles and features. And I should have pointed this out. On the bottom, below role-based or feature-based installation, you'll see remote desktop services installation. A lot of people don't even see this. They go through the wizard so fast. This is the starting point to add VDI or session-based desktop virtualization services in your infrastructure. Clicking on that and moving forward, you can either install a standard deployment, which is a multi-server deployment where you can distribute the various services and roles across multiple servers, or you can do a quick start deployment. This is where, if you're testing in your lab and this is where people start, it'll actually add all the remote desktop services required for a deployment to a single server and then let you proceed. You'll notice that it did find a connection broker already in my deployment, so it's asking me if I want to add some incremental services. Just flipping through the quick start deployment and clicking next, this is where you make the decision as to whether you want to provide a full virtual machine-based desktop deployment or session-based desktop deployment. Again, session being publishing individual apps to users or publishing a shared desktop to those users, rather than publishing a VM to those users for services.
And we're gonna dig into that ad nauseum. We've got a bunch of stuff that explains the differences between the two. With the intent, by the way, someone asked, these slides will be available afterwards if you want to download them, take them to your organization, explain the approach or why you would use a given technology to solve a given problem. There's a lot more in there. But just know, can you roll back to that previous one?
Sure.
But just know that this was so important. Getting VDI was so important, getting it into the system so that it was easy for you to set up. They made it, 8-10 clicks or something?
It's
ridiculously
pretty
low.
Simple.
A very low number of clicks to get there to just get a test environment set up.
So flipping forward again, I select between a virtual machine-based or session-based deployment. Simply moving forward, I select the servers that might be running in that server pool. It adds the roles. It asks me if I'm doing a virtual machine-based deployment. It asks me for a template for the desktop virtual machine that I'm going to publish for everybody. And that is simply a sys-prepped VM that's on Hyper-V already, Windows 7 or Windows 8, that typically you'd put on your connection broker. And it'll go, after it's been sys-prepped and turned off, it'll take that and distribute it out. And we'll show you some of that, what that process looks like. I walk through the wizard. and it just rolls through and it's done.
And there's a reason that we just use screenshots there, because watching it install is like watching paint dry.
Right, and again, when you're doing a VM-based deployment, you think about it, you're taking the contents of a desktop and you're gonna distribute it across a whole bunch of physical servers, so there's a lot of copy time. The casserole has to bake from that perspective.
So what Seven.
We'll look at the server view a little bit. So this is Server Manager. Hopefully you guys have all played with it a little bit. The first point to understand when you do a remote desktop services deployment is this is your UI for managing remote desktop services. Over on the left, you saw the remote desktop services role. This is the user interface that you're going to leverage to manage it. And all the server roles are listed in a nice map. You'll see that there's one green one, the RD Gateway. It's green because it's still available for me to add and configure. I didn't put a remote desktop services gateway here because my desktop services deployment, remote desktop services deployment, isn't internet facing. It's actually just sitting here in a bunch of laptops. So that I didn't deploy that role. And then on the other side of that, you'll see the deployment servers listed. So all of the roles and servers are actually listed here, and I can see their status. If I want to add new servers, I do that through this user interface, no big deal. The core piece of the server manager deployments ends up being the collections. Collections are the groups of applications or VDI-based VMs that I'm actually going to provide as services to my users. Again, there's two different specific types, session-based deployments, publishing applications, or publishing virtual machines, right? So what I've actually got here are two collections. One is a quick session collection, which was actually created as part of my initial quick deployment, and it actually deployed a bunch of applications, session-based applications, I'll show you a little bit later, including things like Calculator and Paint and WordPad, useful applications. But those are already installed on server, and that's why it did it. To add more servers or to add more applications, once they're installed on the server as part of a session-based deployment, I simply have to go to Tasks, Publish Remote App Program, and then I'll get a list of all the applications on my server that are installed that are known to it. I click on them, and it'll publish it out to my end users. It's kind of nice. I can just hit the individual executable. I'm just going to hit cancel. Are you sure you want to cancel this wizard? Yes, I do. And I'll show you how these applications manifest themselves in a little bit. And again, I also have here a Windows 7 pooled-based deployment, and we'll get into more details on that later as well once we get over to that. So we'll switch back to the slide. Or do you have anything else you wanted to?
No, I'm good.
So that's the basics of generating all this.
Right, and so when you get into how do I now use it, so the first thing we're going to cover is remote app. So remote app is one of the capabilities that we've just baked into the platform. And we're going to focus in on this one first. So what's going on in remote app? Well, just like John was showing you, there are applications sitting on that server. Those applications will execute on that server when they're called. And what we'll do is we will send over the wire, over the connection to the client, screen scrapes down to the client. And this is the big differentiating point. Because it's a remote app, you're not getting a full desktop. At the client, you just see an app open up. And a lot of people are saying, well, I want a full desktop down there. Think through that. You can do it. We're going to show you that next. You can do that. But our going in position with a lot of our customers is just publish the apps, because do you really want to manage another full desktop on, say, an Android device? Because that endpoint could be an Android device. It could be a Macintosh, right? Do you want to manage another full desktop or just a centralized app that you want to manage?
Right, and if people are looking, like if you look at an iPad or a Surface tablet, people aren't necessarily looking for a desktop environment. They want an application that's streamed. On an iPad, people are looking for Outlook. So just give them Outlook. Don't give them a whole desktop they've got to navigate
right
through, for example.
And from the user's perspective, this is your screenshot, right, from
right
your desktop?
So this is a screenshot of my Windows RT tablet that I have, and I have two groups of applications, those applications that are installed by natively on that application. On that RT desktop, and the other one's a bunch of remote apps. Notice the things that are on this RT tablet are things like Outlook 2010, which is available to me right there in the screen. RT doesn't support Outlook 2010, but it's integrated directly into the start menu. It looks like it's going to be running locally, and this is one of the first things I installed in my RT tablet. for remote access. So the user experience is identical to the source operating system, or the target operating system from a Windows perspective, because it's integrated in with the start menu. For people who are using a Windows 7 client, it also integrates right into the start menu. And we'll show you how you do that, because it's very simple, under the work resources folder, right? So those are the exact same apps that are published perhaps to my RT device. And by clicking on them, I get an application experience that's integrated. We'll show you in just a minute.
Sure. And so the other thing that this enables is remote desktop sessions as well. And so remote desktop sessions, again, different use case you're supporting here. But with that, you're actually executing what we would call a common desktop on the server. And that entire desktop goes over the connection. And you can be wherever you are on the globe. And for the end user, they get a full desktop. And we've got use cases buried on further on in the deck that show you how all that works. But this is, I need to get a suite of applications is usually that have to interact. This is usually the use case. I have to get those down to the client, and I don't really want to manage that endpoint. I want to manage that centralized desktop. And then finally, we've got VDI. And VDI is what a lot of people want, and when we go through the capabilities that are built into the previous two technologies, a lot of people say, I'm not so interested in VDI because it does require more horsepower. It does require more storage. What goes on in this is, regardless of whether you're using pooled or personal virtual machines, you're going to run multiple virtual machine desktops on that Hyper-V host. And each one of those is consuming its own memory, its own storage, its own processing capabilities, and so forth. So it's a heavyweight. But there are use cases for this as well. When I need to run something that won't run on a server OS, when I need to run something that must run in a client OS, when I have horsepower considerations for those applications.
When a user needs administrative access.
When a user needs administrative access, session. When they want to customize. This is a great scenario, by the way, for developers. Because I need to give developers full access to the machine, they gotta be able to do customizations to it, et cetera, et cetera. And really what we get is the same thing. We're still connecting to RDP over it, but now we're connecting to a client system that is fully functional, can be configured, personal or pooled or whatever you wanna set up on that endpoint.
Yep. So to deploy these VMs, it's very similar, and I took a screenshot of, made a build of the deployment piece, because this is, to do the deployment requires a lot of time to bake it, right? So essentially, once I've got the remote desktop services role installed, if I want to add VM-based VDI to my deployment, I go to remote desktop services, I go to create virtual desktop collection, clicking in the top center of the screen there, and a wizard comes up to create my collection. It allows me to name my collection. I'm going to call this a Windows 8 VDI collection, and it's going to be a group of VMs that are going to be available to end users to remote into. The pivot, as Rich pointed out on the creation, is whether I'm going to make them pooled, which again is a virtual machine running the client operating system that will be run and depersonalized when the user logs out, and then when they log in, it'll repersonalize it and provide their profile information.
And so from education, we use pooled desktops where there's 20 students coming into a classroom. They're going to be there for an hour and a half. They need certain apps. They all have to talk to each other. They bring whatever device they want in the room. We use pooled desktops. Why? Because when they log off that machine and leave the class, the next class comes in and bam, you got 20 new students, but you need that same consistent operating system environment.
Right. So you'll notice in the screen, down at the bottom, there's a lot of hints for you as you go through. Down at the bottom, there's a couple of check boxes that aren't checked. One is, for a pooled VM, as Rich pointed out, you've got transient users. Permanent user assignment doesn't happen for the virtual desktop, right? And administrative access is also not granted to those.
Yeah, we couldn't make this any easier, I'm pretty sure, from a UI perspective.
Now, if I check and I want to go for a personal virtual desktop that's going to be permanently assigned to a user, I just click down, and again, the checkbox changes. Here I'm giving that permanent assignment, and I'm giving administrative access to those users, and it's very clear it will not be recreating the desktop based on a virtual desktop template, or store user settings outside of the VM. Because I'm permanently assigning the VM to the user, the profile lives in the VM, which is different. In pooled, it actually runs in a virtual disk file, a VHDX file, which is similar to, for you VMware administrators, it's like a VMDK file that's created to hold each user's profile that's connected to the VM when they're assigned for a pooled VM.
Mm-hmm.
So walking through this deployment, I had an image I created called Junk. I was very frustrated with myself that day because I had forgotten to sysprep it previously, so I renamed it after I sysprepped it.
Oops.
Silly me. And then when you make the deployment, if it's a simple deployment, I can either use an unattended, I can use a sysprep answer file or just provide some unattended installation settings that I would normally, use to personalize the VMs as I roll through. Things like setting the time zone, right? Setting the domain that it's going to be part of, adding an OU for the machines that are going to be created. One consideration when you're building VMs for VDI is you're going to pollute Active Directory with a lot of machine accounts potentially when you're recreating VMs, when you patch templates for pooled VMs. You're going to have a lot of machine accounts. You don't necessarily want to put those machine accounts in your computers group because it's just going to be it's going to fill up full of stuff. You want to put it into another perhaps OU that you can clean out periodically. So you may want to specify a separate DN for your organizational unit as you do that. You can also, as part of these collections, and again, this is one of the configurable things you can do as part of the initial deployment or later, you assign groups to the VM collections or the session-based collections to grant people access to different applications. If all of the director and above people in an organization need access to an HR application, put them in a group that's directors and above, and then say this application collection is available to that group, and they're the only people who will see that application on their menu. We'll show you that.
Right, and again, education use case for this kind of that kind of assignment is I might have students that come into a class and they have to have the same virtual machine for labs that they have to do throughout the semester. So I'm going to give them personal virtual machines. I'm going to assign a class group, a security group, to the collection, and that's how I tie those two things together. And what I like about this is it's all one console. It's no scripting. You don't have to get deep into the guts. And oh, by the way, it's technology we're all familiar with. I mean, everybody in the room has done a sysprep, I hope. but it's technology you're familiar with, and there are best practices published, and there are references in our deck to this. There's best practices published of how do you get that image as small as possible, because you really want those images to be tiny or as small as you possibly can make them, because you're going to have to duplicate them.
Right. And so the next setting in the middle of the screen is the number of virtual desktops to be created in this collection. So once I have my template and I start creating a collection to deploy, I'm going to want to span those VMs across either one host or multiple hosts. So I need to tell it how many VMs I'm going to create. I specify that here on the screen. I specify the name prefix for the machine accounts for the VMs that are going to be created, and then a starting sequence number, and then I let it roll. And then the next screen, if I had multiple servers in my deployment, would allow me to distribute those VMs across those different boxes. Now, this is really important if you're doing multiple different types of VM-based collections across multiple servers, because you may want to put people who have higher core requirements on boxes that have newer processors or more core density. So those VMs may actually have a different profile. It also may have different availability requirements, but a variety of considerations. And this is where you can have a little granularity as far as pushing those VMs to different physical boxes as part of the deployment. Then you also have choices on where to store the VMs, and this is a really important consideration around storage, because by creating VMs for a VDI deployment, you're actually centralizing I/O that's associated with all those desktops. We'll talk a little bit more about that later, but you have a lot of flexibility for VDI deployments from a Windows Server perspective. You can put those VMs on local disk, you can put it on SAN attached disk, or you can do it how I like, which is actually put them on an SMB 3 share. Mm-hmm. So I can put all of my VMs over Ethernet, the physical storage VHDX files, over Ethernet on a highly available SMB3 share. And I'll get into why that's really important in a little bit. Deduplication, which is built into 2012, it's a secret. Okay, it's not a secret, but it's a supported scenario for VDI, and that's very important for you. So being able to share those on a network share, put them on a clustered shared volume if you choose to, if you want to leverage the CSV capabilities, including something called CSV boot cache, which mm-hmm. is a capability that was built for VDI that allows you to take high I.O., segments of high I.O. that are actually running for VDI and put them into memory on a Windows cluster as part of the boot process. This was added in Server 2012 R2. Why is it important? Because when you come in on a Monday morning and you have 1,000 users that all want to get into a VM and they all boot at the same time or come out of hibernation at the same time, they're all accessing essentially the same blocks to boot. It creates what they call a boot storm in the VDI industry. So by caching that I.O., you can take the boot up of 1,000 VMs from, say, 20 minutes without CSV boot cache enabled down to, say, a minute or 45 seconds, right? Does it make sense? You're all using the same blocks. You're using the same templates in a pooled environment. Why not keep common I.O. there? And we can talk more about image management in a little bit. I'll move a little bit forward. Oh, so for a pooled deployment, the other box at the bottom is pretty important. Automatically rolling back virtual desktop changes when a user logs off. This is the piece, that the secret sauce that depersonalizes the VM and makes it available to other students in Rich's use case coming into a particular environment. For education, for example. Enabling user profile disks is that capability that takes the user profile, you know, under users, username, and actually puts it into a VHDX file to share or to store either on, again, shared available disk or, more importantly, on a SMB share, on a file share, so that those user profiles can be surfaced up to the VMs when the user's logged into a pooled VM. And then with that, you can create the pool, and everything's happy. The collection's created. And that, this last process, takes quite a long time. Why? Because I'm taking that sysprep VM, which could be several gig, 20 gig maybe, 30 gig, depending on the application load, and I'm copying it to a secure place because now it's a template that I'm distributing out to my virtualization hosts. So I'm making multiple copies of 20 gig, 40 gig files that have to move around my network so that then I can provision them up. And again, as part of that provisioning process, because these are pooled, these are shared images, it's going to take that base image and it's going to create a differencing disk for it, which is a change file for that individual VM that runs off this template. It's a delta file, right, essentially for the virtual machine. And it's going to bring it online, attach it to the domain, and then it's going to put it in a saved state so that when a user comes along and wants to use it, it'll be available for them. So there's a lot of I.O. that's going on and a lot of repersonalization.
And that's the key. You just said it. I.O. becomes the key in all of this.
So real quick.
We got a question up front.
Oh, so the question is, there was an option probably here where it says user can be an administrator, or user must be an administrator. We were just talking about pooled VMs. These are shared VMs where a user profile comes up and is attached to the disk. The user logs in and they have their user profile and everything. But because the VM is shared, right, they don't have administrative rights. Because when the machine turns off, it's going to go back to a different state. If you want to give a user administrative rights, they have to have their own dedicated PC, or dedicated VM, as it were. So in order to do that, you would create a personal VM. So a VM that would be, again, you'd use a template to start off with. You'd deploy that template for that user. But once it's assigned, it's their VM. And it's going to be managed like a physical PC going forward, it'll be patched like a physical PC, and they can have administrative rights.
But the key is they can have administrative rights. You don't have to give it to them.
Right.
Okay. But that's why that plays well into the developer scenario, because developers like to put a bunch of stuff on their machine so that they can say, well, it works on my machine. Bad joke for you developers, sorry. But you get it. No, but if you need to give them those rights, there are certain apps that require administrative rights.
Yeah, and still. And we'll talk about some of the pivots around when to use which type of virtualization in a minute.
Yep.
But what I'd like to do real quick is just walk you into, I got to log back into my server.
Okay. You're on screen.
Okay. I'll walk you through the administrative experience for the virtual machines. I showed you a little bit ago my quick session collection. This is where I'm publishing individual apps. On the server side, if I'm publishing VMs, my data center infrastructure is a series of older Dell laptops here. So I don't have, they only have 8 gigs of RAM. So I deployed my virtualization infrastructure for VDI, for VMs. It's just two VMs when I deployed it. Over here on the right side of the screen, I have two VMs that are actually listed, and I see them as virtual desktops, Win 710 and Win 711. So they're Windows 7 SP1 virtual machines that were deployed through that process that we just saw. And the management of them is elevated to me or shown to me through Server Manager. Now, if you're familiar with Hyper-V at all, you'll know that Hyper-V Manager, again, is the underlying virtualization platform that we would use for this. I have the VMs listed here, but in Hyper-V Manager, I actually have other VMs that are listed here, but they're not part of the management domain for VDI. So the VDI deployment or the collection based to those VMs doesn't manifest the other virtual machines to me. So the VMs are actually here. They're available to manage and do things to in Hyper-V, but we don't use that user interface because it's not super valuable for VDI. In Hyper-V Manager, I can't see who the user is that's using the VM, right? So if I go back to Server Manager, we'll see that the administrator is logged into one of these systems, right? That's where that manifests itself, in Server Manager. This is my console for managing VDI, or I can use PowerShell or custom tools as well. The other thing that's interesting to note about VDI on Microsoft's platform is you'll notice that I've got some pretty nutty amounts of assigned memory for these VMs, right? These VMs, one of them's using 662 megabytes of RAM, the other one's using 828 megabytes of RAM. When I assign them as from the template, I assign 2 gigs of RAM to these virtual machines, right? How are they using less? Well, Microsoft uses dynamic memory within our Windows clients on Hyper-V. If the virtual machine isn't using RAM, it gives it back to the hypervisor. This lets us get fantastic densities in VDI from a memory utilization perspective, because very often users aren't using all the RAM that they could use, right? So give it back to other users who might need it so I can pack more users in. Rather than using other technologies to manage memory, like being able to deduplicate memory, which degrades performance for all workloads on the server, or spinning off to disk, swapping to disk, which again degrades performance for all users, why not let the client operating system that knows what it needs for memory manage that and give it back to the hypervisor? So that's one of the benefits of VDI, and one of the great workloads that works with Hyper-V very well in the dynamic memory capabilities. So this is, again, the management from my pool. I don't have a lot of options for these virtual machines. I can save my virtual desktop. I can delete the virtual desktop if there's something wrong with it. Save meaning take it offline and hibernate it. I have a few other tasks, that I can do. I can add additional virtual desktops, which means if I have more demand, I can just roll through the wizard that we saw earlier, tell it I need 4 more of the same, or 10 more of the same, or 100 more of the same, where to distribute them across the server, similar to the initial deployment piece. I can recreate all of my virtual desktops. If there's an issue with my virtual desktops where maybe there's a patch that needs to be deployed, I can take an updated template and deploy it into this collection if I wanted to, or I can create a new collection. But there's a lot of options that I can do that are very common to VDI, and it's all relatively simple and built into the UI. So that's how I would manage the VMs from a basic perspective, how I would manage the basic deployment. And we'll go back to the slides real quick. So the basic differences for personal VMs, those are the ones where you have a dedicated virtual machine. You're not sharing a template and using differencing disks and having a separate external profile. The user can be an admin, and the user can install their own software, right? If I'm contrasting that with a pooled VM, the user can't install software that's going to persist, because as soon as they install the software and log out, software disappears. It's rolled back. They have to install it again. It's not a lot of use in doing that in that type of an environment. But it does potentially simplify things like image management and consistent images across a large number of users. There's other complications around that, but that's kind of one of the key benefits of that. So anything to add on that, Rich?
No, nothing. Okay. We'll talk to this, though, because this is the slide that a lot of our customers spent a lot of time on, because they think about, well, am I going to create this VDI infrastructure with all these virtual machines, like John was just showing, or should I go with session virtualization? And I'll just be blunt. My feedback to most customers is go with a session scenario unless something won't work. Because session is so much cheaper and easier to set up. And when I say cheaper, you don't have to buy large SANs to pull this off. You don't need a ton of storage for all those back-end virtual machines, right? I'm not saying there's anything bad with using VDI. It has use cases. It has great use cases, especially in the education space I work in. But what we tend to tell customers is that if you can deploy your app using session, then do it. And there's no better use case than that than what we just announced this week here at TechEd. The Microsoft Azure Remote App.
I think that's it.
I hung a little.
Because it used to be Windows Azure.
Don't do that. I'll screw it up again.
It's all confusing.
and we're going to show you all this stuff. We're going to get the demo after we see John's fish tanks.
Yeah.
Because the thing that you have to think about is managing all those VDI systems. And the thing that I always tell all my education customers is, and again, there's nothing wrong with it. Don't get me wrong. It's a fantastic technology. Is that you're managing devices anyway. And now when you have a VDI environment, now you have another thing to manage.
Right.
And the promise of VDI has always been, it's been in every magazine, every trade mag out there, is that it's going to simplify everything and solve world peace and all this other stuff. And actually it complicates things because it increases the number of machines that you have to manage.
Yeah.
It does.
Right.
It increases things, you know, routine tasks that we have to look at every month of flash updates and Windows updates and other updates for applications, right? Now I have to do that at a larger scale, which lends itself to automation with like System Center, for example, to help you automate that. And you know, God help you if you're doing VDI and you don't have an automation solution in place for managing that. Those are the big considerations you've got to take into
account. The value of VDI is not to you, it's to the people selling you the infrastructure to do it. Which is, you know, a little bit snarky, but the value of infrastructure to your organization is again, it's not providing a desktop to each user that's centralized. It's providing an application that maximizes shareholder wealth in their job, right? So, for line of business applications that people need, if you can deliver a single line of business application to the user rather than a desktop, that's the most cost-effective thing you can possibly do from an IT perspective, right? Supporting the business through the apps that they need, not expensive infrastructure.
Show me fish tanks.
So I kind of liken VDI to the management of the virtual machines to fish tanks, because I think a lot about fish tanks and virtualization because you're encapsulating things, right? So if I have applications that can all work together as peers, and I can put them on a server, one single server, and project that out to a bunch of users, that's going to be very efficient, right? Just like with fish, I have one tank to clean, everything's cool. If I have applications that don't work together very effectively, I can encapsulate the desktop experience in individual fish tanks, because when you buy fish, you get them in bags, right? And if you could keep them in the bags, you could actually have different incompatible fish, right? You just have to clean the bags. You'd have to get food in there, get air in there, right? But you can't get the same density out of it, and you've got more tanks to clean. So the question becomes, how many operating systems do you want to manage, right? And what's going to be most effective? And that's it. The other big consideration is when you're centralizing desktops, a desktop, typically a vintage desktop, might have a 5400 RPM hard drive in it. It might have a 7200 RPM hard drive in it. It might have an SSD in it. It's a little more expensive. The I/O is associated with the user experience for something for those types of individual drives might range between 50 and 100 IOPS, right? Or IOs per second for those disks. If I'm going to take 1,000 users and centralize their desktop services into my data center, I need a disk subsystem that supports 100,000 IOPS to match that user experience at a minimum. Right? What are you talking about there? You're talking about somebody being very excited about selling you a very expensive disk subsystem, right? And it does, and that's great, and that's what even the folks from Gartner have said, right? 40 to 60% of your total shared remote hosted desktop budget can be spent on simply storage from a project, right? And that's kind of an important consideration. And people don't think about that when they think about centralizing this, because that's a different cost out of their cost model, because it's a capital expense. So with that, how do you mitigate that? If you have use cases where you really need to do shared VM-based desktops, one of the things that snuck into Server 2012
R2.
Well, the first piece.
You're right. Yeah,
we put in Server 2012 the ability to dedupe files, which is kind of neat in the operating system. So you can enable dedupe on a file server volume, and it'll look at duplicate chunks of data on a file server and deduplicate them, which is kind of neat. You can compress all the storage down. In R2, we added another feature called storage tiering, right, which allows me to actually take a volume that I create in storage spaces, which is the ability to take unprotected disks that's in Server 2012 that a lot of people don't know about and haven't played with because it's in a separate storage user interface. I can take unprotected disks, make a big volume. I can take SSDs, put them in that volume, and have the SSDs actually absorb write IOs and accelerate read IO out of that volume. So I can make these combined hybrid disk subsystems out of Windows storage running on a file server. And then we added support for deduplicating VDI-based VMs in this infrastructure. So what does that mean? I can hit those IO limits just using the Windows server you already have, if you own Server 2012 R2. Right? You don't need to buy a storage subsystem from a SAN vendor. You can actually do it very simply, build a file server, enable deduplication on it with tiering, and then present those VMs over an SMB share. So you can meet all those storage requirements without an expensive storage backend. And what I see customers doing is they think about, because it's VDI, they don't need a SAN because it's not a typical data center app. They're more or a typical data center workload. So they do that, and they think about it a little bit differently because of that. Wouldn't you think that?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Desktop workload, I don't need SAN. It's kind of interesting. You got more questions about storage spaces, we can talk about it afterwards.
Forever.
and deduplication and tiering and all that. So, real world.
Well, in the real world, it's not one size fits all. And what we've seen, again, I can use my education experience here, is you use the right solution for the right scenario. And we have various scenarios up here. We do. We've got an iPad that has, it's the smallest one you can buy. I think it's got 16 gigs of storage, and of course, I use that all for movies and music, right? So I don't want to download and install applications on it. I want to run them remotely. Well, that throws itself right at the remote app solution, makes it easy. I've got a Mac sitting here that I want to run the full Outlook client on. Do I really want to connect to a pooled or personal virtual desktop? Well, maybe. If I'm a developer and I'm using a Mac at home and I've got to use development tools that are unique to the organization I'm doing consulting work for, then yeah, connecting into the personal virtual desktop makes perfect sense. And then I'll go back to an example I used earlier. I'm a student and I walk into an organization, walk into my, you know, my lab at school, and I've got my Mac with me supporting BYOD. And the teacher says, okay, connect into this virtual machine, you're gonna use it for the duration of this class, and then you're gonna log out, and then it's going to be destroyed, returned to the pool, what have you. And we're seeing in education a broad swath of the utilization of these technologies, particularly the remote app thing, now that we've announced, Microsoft's announced the Windows Azure remote app, yeah. I'm still trying to get that right, that beacons out those applications directly from Azure, all the while providing that centralized management model.
So people are using a mix of things. They're also, of course, using other virtualization deployment technologies like AppV to actually publish and stream applications. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of arrows in the virtualization quiver that you can combine. So in 75 minutes, we're not gonna get through that.
No.
So with that, we'll go back a little bit to some of the pitfalls, the basic pitfalls and challenges you might have from a VDI deployment. The first thing is license activation and dealing with AD. If you're gonna be doing VM-based deployments, particularly pooled-based VM deployments, activating Office, for instance, and activating the Windows OS will be tricky because, again, you're gonna sysprep it, which depersonalizes the operating system, and then you're gonna put it back in your network and domain join it, but you're gonna have to come back and license or re-enable the license within your infrastructure. If you're a Microsoft Enterprise customer, you probably have access to KMS keys for Windows and Office and those sorts of things, but you may have not yet deployed a KMS server. And what that does is it uses DNS and AD to actually allow you to automatically re-authorize licenses for all your enterprise deployments. You need KMS if you're doing VDI. I'll just leave it at that. If you know what KMS is and you're using it, that's great. If you don't, you should check it out. You also got to make sure that it's going to be configured for Windows and Office and it's working, because I've seen a lot of environments where it hadn't been functioning properly. When you go to build your template, the template again is a client operating system that you're going to build, Windows 7, SP1, or Windows 8, or 8.1, and then you're going to sys prep it, so put in the apps that you want for that base image, excuse me, and then sys prep it. There's a funny little quirk around Windows 8 that you may run into as you do your first deployment if you want to, which is if you go to the App Store and log in and use any apps or add new apps, sysprep won't function after that. And it won't function because now what you've done is you've actually customized applications in the context of a user that sysprep can't depersonalize. So sysprep will throw all sorts of errors. So the important safety tip is if you're building VMs for Windows 8, or 8.1, don't go to the store before you sysprep, if that makes any sense. And again, there should be a good session on Windows 8 and Windows 7 optimization after our session today, if you're interested in that. Add the KMS keys to the VMs before you sysprep, so you have them. And there are, for those of you who don't know about KMS, there are generally well-known KMS product keys out on Microsoft.com on the TechNet site. I usually Bing for KMS Appendix A, and it gives me a list by operating system of product keys, and I thought I struck gold the first time I saw it, but all the product keys really do is it tells the product to go look at your internal licensing server. That's all it does. And they're just well-known keys, and they're there by operating system, and it's something useful to know. But add those before you sysprep, because then you're going to take your template, you're going to turn it on, and you're not going to have to worry about activation ever again. And then also include the app v client on your template before you deploy, if there's any chance you're ever going to use it to stream applications in. And there's app v sessions probably, well, there have been all week, I think. Mm-hmm. Sysprep's a pretty useful tool, particularly now with Windows 8. A new switch setting was added specifically for virtual desktop, and it's, slash mode VM. Mm-hmm. So it's actually wrong on the slide. It's a sysprep/VM. What that does is it doesn't go through the same rigor associated with depersonalizing the VMs because it understands that you're not going to go back and detect all sorts of crazy hardware after the fact, so it doesn't need to pull as much out. So it actually makes the repersonalization much more quick. Mm-hmm. And then you can, when you get everything ready to go on your VM, export your VM before you sysprep it or take checkpoints of it. That way you can come back and patch your VM continuously and export it again later, because again, if you haven't used sysprep, it depersonalizes an operating system instance. There's only X number of times you can do that before it gets very upset with you. So if you sysprep it and take your image, patch it again, and sysprep it again, you're burning those sysprep instances, right? Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of guidance on the RDS blog, which is available to you. There's a Microsoft Remote Desktop Services blog that's worth looking at. What we want to do now is go into the client demo piece, if that's okay. There's a bunch of ways to get into remote desktop services once you have your infrastructure up, whether it's session-based or VM-based. MSTSC, which if you're an admin you've used, which is just the RDP client, is available to you. There's a remote desktop web access for you to activate it when you're going to your RDS infrastructure, and the URL to get to your RDS infrastructure once you deploy it is just https://server/rdweb, and you'll get an OAuth-like login experience that'll require credentials. The other thing you can do is publish apps, as I showed earlier, from using your control panel, using either a slightly longer URL, or actually, if you configure it, you can actually use your individual user's name and domain to actually personalize it all for you, or you can use the app from the store for the various devices that you have.
And that's what we've loaded up here.
Yeah. The one thing to note is you do need to deal with certificates. So if you're playing with this in your lab from a deployment perspective, first thing you're going to notice when you go to that OAuth-based login for RDWeb is there's a problem with the website security certificate. Why? Because there isn't one, probably. You actually have to register the cert if you're playing around in your lab on the client device and distribute it somehow. If you've got an external cert, you're probably fine from a trusted root authority, so this isn't a big deal. But if you're just monkeying around with this in your lab, you're going to need to put the cert on the client because you can't do that extra step on control panel to publish the apps to the start menu without that, because it would be coming from an untrusted site. So all this slide is just walking through how you might actually do that within Internet Explorer. So essentially, you go up to where the cert is, you view the certificate, you install the certificate, in case you've never done this, put it on the local machine. And again, this is for your lab environment. Don't do this for your production environment. Right. It's crazy. I put it in a crazy place in the store. It's fine. Then it imports it.
It's not recommended.
Then after that, you'll be able to go to the remote app and desktop connections piece on control panel. Click access remote app, and put in a URL that's very similar to the RDS one with just feed/web feed. And the example on Windows 8 and 8.1 is actually right there below, right? So it actually gives you an example URL. In the Windows 7 configuration, it doesn't give you the example URL. So, but it's useful. Once you put that in, you hit next, and it publishes the apps. RDP 8.1, which is the current version of the RDP protocol, is awesome. It gives you really crisp text. The experience is really great. It makes the sessions come back and quick much more quickly, and you get full multi-touch and gesturing support as part of it. I was playing Cut the Rope, remoted in on my RT device to a lab this morning in Chevy Chase, Maryland, just for fun, but I didn't wire it up because I didn't have as many connections here as we wanted. And you get full integrated single sign-on. And again, there's client support for Windows 7, Windows 8, 8.1, RT, iOS, Mac, OS X, and Android.
So let's go right to showing off some cool stuff. So this is my Mac. And this is the remote desktop app that I loaded from the store on Monday. And the reason I loaded it on Monday is because something new appeared on Monday. And the thing that appeared on Monday after TechEd was over was this little Microsoft remote app up here. I'll cover that in a bit. But everybody always asks me, how do I get Outlook on my Mac? Well, publish it through remote app. This is the experience the end user goes through launching Outlook, and this is one of those moments where I just hope there's nothing embarrassing in my email. By the way, use proper licensing. Obviously, this is a test environment. And so this is my mail that's running, this is Outlook running on my machine. It's just running in a terminal services window, that's it. This is the best example that I've got for remote app, because everybody in the audience has asked me, or many people in the audience have asked me at one point, how do you get Outlook running on a Mac? I don't like the Mac version in Office. I got a nodding head over here. Well, this is one way you can do it.
I was just at one of Rich's customers and their education and healthcare concern, and they needed to be able to fax from Outlook on the Mac.
Right.
There's no support for it, right? Well, what are they doing? They can do this.
Right. And so there's great use cases around this. Any app can follow me anywhere around the globe. And what I mean by follow me around the globe, I've shown you one experience here. The one experience being using a pre-plumbed remote desktop client. Okay. And I'll just show the remote app stuff here too. This is what we added in. We added in this preview stuff for remote app. For Microsoft technology, and all I'm going to do here is I'm just going to put in.
So this is the ability that you can deploy all the session-based or VM-based stuff that we've talked about on premises. This is just doing session-based in Azure, right? So you can put a VM in Azure with a VPN back to your domain, put your own apps up there, so you don't have to buy the hardware and buy all the disk, but then publish your own session-based apps out to your users using this service, or you could use the Office components that are there in the services in preview right now.
Right, and it's extremely powerful because think about it. I'm a Mac user. Well, I'm not, but I'm a Mac user. All I care about is getting the applications that I need on my Mac. That's it. I don't want a Windows desktop. The same thing on this iPad over here. I don't want to run a Windows desktop on an iPad. I can, but tried to run a full desktop on a mini? Not much fun. So we've provided a new experience where, and these are the apps that are published today, and like Excel, for example, and PowerPoint and Word.
And the Azure Remote App experience that's up there, those are the ones that are by default, but it's all of the Office 2013 piece. If Rich went into the administrative console on Azure, he could actually publish Outlook as well. So you could run Outlook in Azure, pointing back to wherever Exchange is to access your mail.
And so, not to commit Microsoft heresy, but what we're doing is we're looking at an OS, any OS now. I'm not going to say any OS. You notice Ubuntu wasn't on that list.
Skull wasn't on the list.
Wasn't on the list, yeah. Right? Because there are RDP clients for those environments, right? That, frankly, I haven't tested with this. I've tested some Linux systems with this, and it just works. But the supported ones out the gate will allow you to get to this, where I'm just thinking about the OS as a container of applications. And think about all this. You've got users that come into your organization, you want to centrally manage their apps. Okay, let's use remote desktop for that. Let's use our remote desktop services like this and publish those individual applications using remote app. And then when that person leaves my organization, guess what? I deactivate their account in Active Directory, and by virtue of that, they can't use these applications anymore. I haven't distributed anything out to the client because I don't have to. And that is one of the beauties of what we've built in the preview that's going on
now. And an interesting point, as Rich said, there's a lot of different use cases for the VDI piece, and we'll show you the client stuff on Windows in just a second. In the client on the Mac, for instance, he had his work resources from his on-premises published VDI deployment, and he had Office running in Azure all in one client, and it was kind of a cool thing to see all of that integrated for one set of users.
It's
so
really
you could actually, you know, so it's different different scenarios that can be supported different ways. You could put an SAP, a heavy SAP client, either in Azure, right, or you could put it on-prem and publish it out through the gateway. So let me.
I'm still going. Okay. You can't. No. So this is the Windows experience. So we talked earlier about that there would just be. I know I cut you off. Sorry.
That's okay. You go ahead.
This is what you get. This is an out of the box experience of what you get for a website. And you can customize the heck out of this. I'm not a developer, so I never touch it. But if you just do the standard deployment, this is where you wind up. And when I sign in here, I'm going to see my published applications that are, you know, published out to me. And behind the scenes, as an administrator, I can customize the heck out of these. I won't launch it, but I could, like, for example, set up IE in kiosk mode. So behind the scenes, in the administrative console, that specific link right there will launch a kiosk mode version of Internet Explorer. So I can still do all that cool guy stuff of adding in additional parameters for starting up these apps.
You could organize applications and folders for admin tools or different lines of business, and of course grant those access to those individual apps on a per user group basis in the collection piece. So we should show you on the collection side how that works as well, because it's just you permission an individual collection. And then when a user comes in, they just see what they see, right?
And so I leave this in. You can hide this. You can change all these parameters behind the scenes so the end user never sees this. But this, again, throws out the whole use case scenario discussion of, well, you know, maybe I don't want the user to save to their local drive. So maybe by default, they wouldn't even have this option. Maybe I don't want to support plug-and-play devices. I think you get the picture. Maybe I don't want to let them print locally. But you have centralized management over this. And when I connect in, I'm going to be running Publisher, but I'm not going to be running Publisher. Publisher's just running out on a server somewhere. And the somewhere for this server is running up in Azure. So you can run these services up in Azure. You can run them on premises if you darn well feel like it. And again, I didn't activate my copy of Office. That's why I'm getting this. But it's the same version of Office, and now I can run Publisher. And if you look at what's running on this system, just looking at Task Manager, you're not seeing Publisher, you're just seeing additional remote desktop connections that are being opened up to support this. And
the other thing, can I show one thing on this?
Sure.
I'm going to close out this. The other thing that's interesting to note is when you hover over the icon for Publisher, you get the preview. So that was one of the things that was added back based on feedback for end users. In earlier versions of the RDP client, when you saw the remote desktop collection or the remote desktop session there, you didn't get the same experience on the Windows client that you did. So if you're running a movie or something else, you'll actually see it in the preview in Windows 8.
Yeah, I'll end on this bit and then you take over, okay? So the other thing you need to know from a Windows perspective is the remote app over on the left here. This is the new remote app client that installs when you set up remote app. And there's a free trial. You don't have to do anything except go to sign up for the free trial to get this running. And it's different from than the full remote desktop connection client over here. It's different, but it's the same. And when I say that, it's using the same under the covers technology. It's using the same binaries. But at the end of the day, it just has a different look and feel from a skin perspective, from an interactive use perspective. And notice there's a nice send feedback on this one. And I could launch Word again, but it wouldn't be that exciting. John, I'm going to flip over to you so you can show another one of the VDI things. What
sure.
are you, seven?
The first thing I was going to do is I mentioned when Rich showed that list of applications that he had in his website, if you're going to permission different users, right, if I can go up to my collections, where do I do that? No, it's on the individual collection task, isn't it? Edit properties. I edit the properties for my collection. So I'm on the quick session collections piece, and I do the user group. So if I have individual apps I want to give to a group of people, this is where I do it. I just put them in a group in AD, and I just permission the collection, and then they will or will not get the application on that page. The other place they will or will not get it, based on adding it in control panel, as I showed you, is on the start menu. So these are the five apps that I have access to from this VDI deployment. And I'm showing you, I'm actually demoing from my domain controller. He's not a VDI host, and a VDI host is a Dell box sitting here under my water, another laptop. If I go back to my desktop, we'll see some of those other things that I mentioned from a client perspective. Here I've got Windows Media Player. If I hover over the Media Player icon, you'll see a preview. The other thing that connotes that it's a remote desktop connection session for a remote app is the little green set of arrows. You'll notice a little circle with two little green arrows. That says it's running remotely. The really important thing to understand is the RDP protocol performance is fantastic. It's fantastic on all the clients. So what I had here was a video just to show that, because it's always the test. And this is a video from when the Red Sox did very well this last year. And this is in honor of the Bruins.
The Red Sox have won it. And what a stunning reversal of
from
fortune.
From earlier.
From 93 long.
The Bruins didn't do too well last night in hockey. So I put this on. But the video performance is really good. The video's running back on my VDI host, right? It's rendering on my local VDI client, and it looks like a full video. It is a full video, though it's not, nobody's talking right now. There's somebody talking. There's some video that's moving around. And the point being that the experience is good with the protocol. It's great. It's been optimized for low bandwidth situations, and it's been optimized for video and audio delivery. So I turned the audio down a little bit so I could talk over it. But if I go back and I look at the preview, I see the preview as well. Same spot. So that's the point. The client's kind of useful. It works very well, and you can publish a variety of things with that. So,
right. Very powerful. And so when we talk about what John was just showing you versus the Windows Azure remote app piece, just think about scalability and elasticity. That's it. That's the key. You have to go through a lot of considerations to do remote app on premises in terms of scaling servers and whatnot. What we're doing out in Windows Azure remote app, you're going to think about that less because that service will match your need. The centralized management, that changes as well. We didn't show you the centralized management stuff from the Azure portal, just due to time, really. But if you look at this blog post at the very end, there's a phenomenal walkthrough of what the administrative experience is like for a remote app. I think you saw the management tools experience there will be what you will see are very different. And then the clients, you should say, on Windows are different. On the Mac, on the iPad, we've baked the latest update into for a remote app from Windows Azure. We baked it right into the clients that are germane to those platforms. They're different on the Windows platform. And then it really changes you to think, well, am I doing infrastructure as a service versus a platform or software as a service now? It's really changing the way you think about this technology. And Windows Azure Remote App has tremendous potential for meeting very specific use case requirements in education. For me, I think you'll find that there'll be more of that coming as we develop the service. And what's going on in Windows Azure Remote App is very similar to what we saw in Remote App from earlier. Same concept, applications are executing out on the Azure platform, and there are options for bringing your own applications out there. Don't think it's just the Windows stuff that we're seeing now, just the Office stuff that we're seeing now. There are options to bring your own out there. Again, we just don't have time to get into all of it today. And there's a how to get started blog post at the bottom of this. You're still centrally managing those apps on Azure. You can sign up for the preview in Azure so that you can start doing this. And we've included some links on all this so that you can go out and get the new clients, so that you can go out and access the Azure Remote App website to get your questions answered.
I think the interesting piece for Azure Remote App, and again, you can use this in conjunction with on-premises based session deployment or VDI deployment. The interesting piece is, I think, how they implemented file access. One of the things that's pointed out on this slide is it says persistent storage per user is 50 gigs. It's actually using OneDrive Pro for file access. Right, so by using it in the trial tenant, if you're using OneDrive Pro, people's files, and this is how I operate with OneDrive Pro, right? I have a local directory on my PC or my user profile with all my OneDrive files. I put all my work files there, right? So it's replicated to OneDrive Pro. I can go into this tenant from an iPad or an Android device or my RT device, which isn't participating in my work network, and access those documents because I'm authenticated into the client as part of my Office 365 piece, and get those exact same documents because I'm not running them on the device. I'm running them in the RDP session, which is local to Azure, which is secured to my documents. Right, so it's kind of an wrapping your head around how this changes how you might deliver apps and services to your users is it's crazy. We're still working through it. Rich and I are, because this is relatively new to us.
Yeah, our whole demo and presentation changed on Monday when they announced Remote App. Dead serious. So we've been massively refactoring this. The other thing I'll throw out is we really do want your feedback. We really want your feedback. You know, sometimes people come up to me and they say, you know, I really wish this one thing in Office would change. Who can I talk to about that? Or I wish you would change this. Go sign up for the Remote App out in Azure and give us feedback. We'll build the plane that you want, but we're building this sucker as we fly it sometimes. So flat out, we really do want your feedback on how we can make a service that's valuable to you. And the reason that I say that is VDI in and of itself has proven very successful, and I always focus on these use cases that the folks at Georgia Tech did. Fantastic use cases around how do I deliver out to my engineering students these applications that I need to run that have serious demands. So they went with personal virtual desktops in this case. And I would bet that everybody in this room has had a lab set up like this somewhere. I would just bet that, because I know I did. It was in our case, for one project I was on, it was about a development lab where we would go through and we would re-image the machines every single night to get them to a core image, right? And these are their slides, hot, noisy. It was a noisy room. The teachers hated that they couldn't see the students. There's a number of things that are in their use case, and it's a phenomenal set of case studies. What they went to were little terminal devices on the tables connecting to VDI on the back end, and then they went to the same screens that I was showing you earlier and just customized them. Really cool stuff that they did over at Georgia Tech. And at the end of the day, the end user gets a desktop that has the right applications that they need. You can get the full case studies out on our website. But think about this. Now I don't need a specific Windows machine, and I don't need to involve another partner. Now I could actually do this off of a Mac. I could do it off an iPad if I wanted to. And again, there's other case studies around this. And again, most of my stuff focuses on education, but this is all about IT having centralized control over those applications and those desktops, and you bring in whatever device you need to that you want to do your computing on. I can deliver those apps to you as an end user, and you don't have anything installed in your machine that you can walk away with. It's very, very powerful what you can do with this. There are related sessions that are coming up. And where's the one?
It's next page.
Next page?
Next page.
Yeah. I'm not trying to gloss through these, but the advanced VDI optimization that's coming up, we were talking to the consultant that's leading that discussion. Highly recommend that. So those are coming up.
There was also a session on AppV that's right. competing with that one. If you're interested in that, that's a great technology for streaming as well. Hopefully we can take a couple of questions. If there's interest, you got a question, one more thing I would just want to bring out. The use case that I run into every time I go into a customer is somebody just bought 100 iPads and gave them to everybody. And now they want to do remote stuff. Right, or whatever. They want to use, that's why we're going to do VDI, because we just gave 100 iPads to somebody, right? I'd rather with us 100 RT devices. Everything we're doing now will help you do that, use those devices and provide business applications to those devices. If we have a couple of minutes, we'll try to use this device to show the iPad mini and what the client experience looks like going into Azure MoDAP, because it's really awesome. But while you're getting that set up, maybe we'll have a question from you and a question from you first. They got a mic up.
Hello?
Hello. Oh, we can hear you now.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. My name is Judith Richards.
Now I can't hear you because you're away from the mic.
My name is Judith Richards, and I'm with McDonald's.
Oh, okay.
And we are looking at the Windows Multipoint.
Multipoint server.
Server. So I'm curious how different it is.
Well, you know, and that's great. We had so many things to cover, we pulled our multipoint servers out. Multipoint is an underutilized version of remote desktop services that was geared and marketed towards education, but there's certain use cases that we're finding are kind of interesting. It allows you to deploy essentially RDS services from a relatively light server infrastructure and do interesting things like shadow people and do other things. And there's some interest in it in retail environments when people want to use it for point of sale, for instance, maybe at your organization. And there's a lot of value because you can use a thin client device, leverage Hyper-V on the back end to do a bunch of other things in a store, centralize everything, and reduce a bunch of costs. So there's a lot of interesting things going on with it. We just don't have a lot of, we can talk more about it with you afterwards if you'd like. That'd be great.
But for the rest of you that are in the room, and we'll get to one more question, the rest of you that are in the room, what Multipoint did with this technology we're looking at is it gives you centralized control, gives the teacher centralized control over those sessions. So they can blank out everyone's session and say, well, Johnny over here is doing it all right. Let me beacon what Johnny's doing. Or let me shut off everybody's session all at once so eyes are on me.
Right.
That's what Multipoint adds on top of this. And believe me, that's a whole other 2 hour
but
session.
But it's a perfect example where, you know, you're in a retail organization and every half fraction of a penny you can save saves you money. That's a case where doing session-based stuff with Multipoint service saves you a bunch of money, and VDI would be cost prohibitive, right?
Yeah. And so I've got the Mac, the iOS running.
Oh, hopefully there. You guys can see this. The lighting's kind of nutty.
It's not too bad.
On the big screen?
Mm. Yeah. Next question, please.
Hello.
There you go. You're on.
Yeah.
Now you're off.
Maybe come up to the other mic. Oh, there you go. Whoa.
Sorry. So quick question on the remote app. Can you do session sharing, like, say, if you've got a URL within that Outlook that you had on remote app, or a link connection that you want to click on, and can it launch link within that session or IE within that session?
So can I launch, you could publish link within RDS, and you could publish IE within RDS, certainly, right? Publishing link within RDS can be somewhat problematic based on bandwidth and other constraints that you might have and the workloads that you use. What I found with link in RDS is people don't typically, and I've used it and it works, right? It's not an optimal scenario typically if you're just using the link client. RDS has been optimized to use link so it'll actually push the I/O or the network connection from some of the thin client devices, and this is an RDP8 enhancement, to a side device that has its own network device for audio redirection that works very fast. Hey, yeah. There's applause in Mark's session. Sorry. And that's kind of useful. But Link works very well. People are always concerned about running video with Link. I think the uptake personally with video and Link, and there was an article in Wired Magazine and video in general, is pretty low because when you do video conversations, it destroys the perception that you're paying attention. because people are typically not looking at you in video when you're doing work, so people don't use it as much. So I think it's more of a concern that people have, but it works. Citrix had a really good guide for optimizing with Link 2010, and I think everything they had in there, like dropping the frame rate and all those things, are very effective. From a support perspective, I can't speak to it for Link, but I know people are doing it.
So it will do session sharing with Outlook and IE, and say if you publish all those remote apps.
So you're saying, will RDS allow you to do session sharing? Oh, will session sharing
will they
in
interact
Link
with
work?
Each other, those apps?
No.
No.
Okay. No.
Now, what you got to do in that scenario, that's a great scenario for the full desktop being published out.
Okay. Thank you.
Then we'll go to this mic over here for this gentleman. He's been patient.
Yeah, with a session-based deployment, when I'm setting up applications to be pushed out like that, do we still need to set them up like in the old terminal server days with change space user install before installing the application on the server?
It's a completely different experience.
Okay.
It's a completely different experience. And you'll see across the board, the experience of managing in 2012 R2 is completely different from anything that we dealt with in 2008 or earlier. Nothing against those, but it was horrible to add, for example, a remote desktop session host. It was an inordinate amount of work to just add that in. Now it's a right click and add.
And we just got the hook. We're done. So if you've got other questions, we're happy to talk with you. Yeah. Our light's still green. But anyway, we appreciate your time. Hopefully you got a taste of the deployment piece. If you have any questions, come up and we can give you a business card. We'll chat with you. Thanks.